Man, I really should have read this article earlier. Guess I'll read it while I'm talking to you about other stuff. No, I probably won't. Anyway, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Today on the show, I'm going to interview Trevor Aronson about the first part of his article. No, I got two breaks. I can speed read. It's the case of the government of the United States of America versus Sammy Osmakak. Well, so who do you think won? Yeah, the government. The great Trevor Aronson. He wrote the book that I wanted to write about all the bogus terrorism plots dreamt up by the FBI. And it's called The Terror Factory. He's got a big in-depth piece at Mother Jones from a few years back all about it, too, that highlights a lot of the cases. And, man, the book will knock your socks off. And I guess I never did watch that Newberg, the HBO movie about the Newberg thing, but I guess he's in that. I think that might be based on his work. But anyway, now here's Trevor Aronson writing for The Intercept. And the piece is called How the FBI Created a Terrorist. And there are at least 50 of these, 50 of these. And this is not just bogus cases. I mean entrapment. Because there are hundreds of bogus cases where an informant just makes up lies, or a guy facing life in prison for something else makes up a bunch of lies, or people are tricked into doing something or another. But it's right around 50 are the ones where the FBI just outright finds an innocent person and entraps them into, you know, so-called Al-Qaeda terrorism, and then busts them. And you're probably pretty familiar with some of these anyway. But so here's the new one. This one, or it's not new, but there's new news about it. From Tampa, Florida, I think. Anyway, gotta finish reading this thing. Anyway. The government. See, the problem is there are no Al-Qaeda guys in America. So they have to pretend there are so that they can make money and have power and not have to get real jobs and make you afraid and support their horrible foreign policies, too. But mostly I think this is about the bureaucratics of being an FBI agent. For the FBI, job one is protecting the FBI. And coming up with excuses why we need them. Like, for example, oh, this guy was going to suicide bomb me if we hadn't stopped him. Yeah, sure he was. How the FBI created a terrorist here at The Intercept today, yesterday, and today. And Trevor Aronson will be on the show to talk about it. And, you know, I think I'm going to try to use one of these breaks to call NIAC and see if I can get Trita Parsi on the show. Because I like asking Trita Parsi things. And I like hearing him answer about stuff. Very important news going on with the Iran talks, so sure would like to have a guest on that. But then again, I can talk all about the Iran talks, too. I could let you know all kinds of things about that, if that's what you want. And also, of course, Israeli politics. They're having elections today. Polls must be closing around Israel time now, huh? Something like that. Soon. Although, we won't really know what's going to happen, possibly for a few weeks or even a couple of months, because it's not just a winner-take-all, simple majority or plurality type of a situation. No, in fact, it's a parliamentary coalition-building type situation. And so, in theory, Likud could lose and Netanyahu could still stay the president or the prime minister anyway. Theoretically. But I guess we'll see. And anyway, so we got some news to cover along those lines as well. We got Iraq news. Oops, that's supposed to be on quiet. Yeah, got Iraq, man. I might cover this right now here in a sec. Oh, yeah, in Ukraine and et cetera. Plenty of news to cover on the show for you today. I might even bring up OKC since it got brought up this morning. Oh, by me, I guess. But anyway. The battle for Tikrit's been called off. Quote-unquote, Iraq, meaning the Shiite militias and what's left of the Iraqi army that, so-called Iraqi army George Bush built. They have failed to take Tikrit. They said they were stopping because they were waiting for reinforcements, but now Jason Ditz has this article at news.antiwar.com, and he's linking to the National over there, .AE, that is, Iraq puts Tikrit offensive on hold. Iraq put its Tikrit offensive on hold on Monday as senior officials called for more airstrikes to dislodge ISIL militants who have laid explosives across Saddam Hussein's home city and still hold its central districts. And as Jason says, they claim they moved the goalposts back and said, or maybe moved them forward and said, oh, yeah, you know what? Actually, the mission was just to take the surrounding suburbs and small villages on the outskirts of Tikrit. We never did say we were trying to take Tikrit, you know. Wow, really? That's all you got, huh, Bottom Brigade? All those years of when they stand up, then we'll stand down. We got to train up this army. We got David Petraeus over there. He's going to train up this army for us. We got the awakening sons of Iraq, and we're integrating them into the security forces. Whole thing's a catastrophe. They can't even take Tikrit. And Tikrit, as Mitch Prothero was saying on the show, is a, I forgot what proportion he used, but it's a much smaller town than Fallujah or Mosul. Mosul's a town of 2 million people. That's bigger than Austin, Texas, by a lot. And the Islamic State apparently has it on lockdown. And if the Bada Brigade, I always wondered, you know, I admit I was surprised and I was kind of chasing. I guess I was wrong. Here the Shiite militias really are going to try to take these Sunni territories. Meh, no, not so much. I guess I was right in the first place. Why would they? I mean, I guess Mosul is certainly a bridge too far, but Tikrit, I could imagine them fighting for it. I guess that's why I've been so paranoid that what's going to happen is the Shiites are going to come and colonize Tikrit and take it, is because I guess I can't really figure out why else they'd fight for it. And here they, even with Iranian coordination, they can't even take Tikrit. They sure as hell can't take Mosul. And they're saying, oh, but you know what? We really should have invited the Americans along and used their air power, and then that would have helped. Yeah, maybe. But they would have had to just carpet bomb the crap out of the center of the city and kill a lot of innocent people, too, to really make a difference with air power in a situation like this. Urban combat could level the place. Drop daisy cutters on them all, but then that's sort of counterproductive for the whole thing about we're here to help you and all that. Killing everybody who lives in the middle of the city. However many civilians are left there. So anyway, I don't know, man. I keep thinking that it's just Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they can't be that powerful, really. I mean, they're fighters. They're a militia, you know? But I guess we're... I disagree with Patrick Coburn. I'd have shut the hell up and listen to him, man. And he says, hey, don't sell them short. They've got a state. It's as big as Britain. They got 100,000 men, plausibly. He says that's what the Kurdish president says, and he believes it somewhere near there. Who's going to get rid of these guys?
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, I'm Scott Horton, and I think it's hilarious, in a not very funny kind of way, how Israel is just like the old South over there. And with the Jews in the place of the white supremacists. Does that make any sense to you? Bunch of Jewish Klansmen with a state of their own? That's what it's like. From BuzzFeed this morning, Shira Frenkel, Netanyahu's dire warnings of Arab turnout drive rush to the polls. And Likud has sent text messages out to, I guess, every phone in Israel or what? That says, the Arabs are coming. Netanyahu put a video statement on his Facebook page saying the Arabs are voting in droves. The right-wing government is in danger. The Arabs are being bussed out. And I know what you're thinking. Palestinians can vote in Israeli elections? No, of course they can't. Palestinians are much less than 3/8 of a human or something under Israeli law. They don't get to vote for nothing. But the Arab Israelis, quote unquote, who are Israeli citizens, carefully balanced, a 20% super minority. Is that a word? When by law they make sure that they have an 80% super majority Jewish population among the citizenry. Anyway, so there's a possibility that Netanyahu is going to lose. It's a neck and neck kind of thing. He called for these elections thinking it would strengthen his position, and now he's in a tough position. So he's come out and has avowedly said that he will never, there will never be a Palestinian state on the West Bank, which, of course, we all knew that Likud never meant to negotiate a Palestinian state. And even when he claimed he did mean to negotiate a Palestinian state, he defined that as something that no one else would call a state anyway. But still, his pretension, Likud's pretension that, oh yeah, you know, we would negotiate under the right circumstances, and if only Hamas will kiss our ass just right, or blah, blah, blah. That has been something that's been convenient for American and other government officials to hide behind, I guess European ones, that maybe there's something to a future, to a two-state solution here under a Likud government. But now, for a very short-term gain, he hopes, he's outright disavowed ever negotiating a Palestinian state. In fact, I read one thing that said, really, he's probably not going to get very many more votes for that. The people who really wanted to hear him say that and don't like him because he hadn't said that in the past, recently or whatever, they already have their candidates and they're not coming to him. But if anything, he probably lost votes by saying that. And so anyway, his solution is, well, just imagine if... just imagine if the Arab groups had sent out text messages to all the Arab, Christian, and Muslim Israelis saying, the Jews are coming out in droves to vote. We have to stop them. Right? All you have to do is put the shoe on the other foot for just one moment. Or if the American Republican Party sent text messages out to everyone in America saying, the blacks are coming out in droves. Vote Republican. We gotta stop them. and identify them like that. Not the liberals are coming out to vote. Not those people who we politely disagree with in our democracy are coming out to vote. But those others. Those racial minority members. They have their act together. They're working against us. We have to stop them, says the Prime Minister of Israel. Who, again, whose foreign minister in his current coalition government just the other day said that Arab Israelis, that is, Israeli citizens, Arab Muslims and Christians, should have their heads chopped off with axes for disloyalty, which of course could mean disagreement with the policy of the government in any way, right? And he wasn't kidding. And he wasn't, you know, drunk and caught on camera musing to a friend. It was a statement by the foreign minister's office or whatever, by his campaign anyway. He meant it. I think he said at a rally, they should be beheaded for disloyalty. That's Avigdor Lieberman. This is Israel. This is America's greatest ally, even though you can't name anything they ever did for us ever. This is the great democracy, Israel, where half the population can't vote. Half the population are enemy aliens inside their own country, occupied by a foreign power in the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Oh, and I know the apologists for Israel will say, nuh-uh, the Israelis withdrew from Gaza. No, all they did was move all the last of the settlers out and turn it outright into a concentration camp, into a giant prison, where, get this, the majority are minors. Isn't that interesting? I guess they're really not minors, are they? When you're a person of majority in Gaza, that means you're age just born through 18. Because most of the prisoners of the Gaza Strip are just kids. Many of them born, huge percentages of them born since Gaza was, Hamas was elected in 2006. So a lifetime ago to half of them. Half of the majority. And none of them, by definition, could have possibly voted back in 2006. None of them. And they're the majority. And they're prisoners. And most of them are all just the children and grandchildren of the refugees from 1948 anyway. Kicked out of the rest of what's now called Israel, their land, at gunpoint. They don't get to vote for the Knesset, do they? Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East, except for half the population can't vote because they're Muslims and because they're actually from there, rather than being a bunch of white people from Europe and America who are subsidized to come, who have the right of return to a place where they're not from. You know, I wasn't raised Jewish at all. My grandma was Jewish, but so I supposedly have a birthright to live at taxpayers' expense on the West Bank. I have the right, quote unquote, to steal land from Palestinians on the West Bank right now, but they don't have the right to even that land, much less the land that they got kicked out of on the other side of the line. Yeah, what a great liberal democracy Israel is. If only we could be just like them. Oh, except we're proud that we're not like that anymore. Not that bad, anyway. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our guest today is Trevor Aronson, author of the book, The Terror Factory, that I wish I'd written, but he did a better job than I would have anyway. It's all right. He's also got one at Mother Jones called The Terror Factory as well. That's a great explanation of all this stuff. Trevor, welcome to the show. Your phone sounds absolutely terrible. What's going on?
I'm not sure. As soon as you got off the line, I started having this clicking noise. Is it bad?
Yeah, I'm going to call you back.
You want to reconnect?
Yeah, we'll try it again.
Okay.
All right, so I got to figure out some audio to play to you because I got to talk to the receptionist lady to get his line and all that. So probably shouldn't play the Dayglo abortions. Let me see here. Oh. I'll just play you some Victoria Nuland. I could play some Dirty Ernie. No, you don't want to hear that probably. All right, where the hell is this Nuland kook anyway? All right, Nuland, Ukraine, 4 minutes. All right, hang on.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister, and you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now, so we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yats, and I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario, and I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Cleach should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think what in terms of him
all
not
right,
going
all
into
right.
the government,
you guys
just let him sort of stay out
plotting their coup d'état a million times.
I'm just thinking.
All right, we got Trevor Aronson on the show here. Let's see if we got this phone working right. Oh, sounds good to me. Hey, Trevor, how are you?
Great, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Good. Very happy to have you on. Here you are writing for The Intercept, and I was telling them before, the book is The Terror Factory, and it's really great, and as you write it up in there, there are 50 cases, at least, out of a few hundred bogus terrorism prosecutions in this country since September 11th. There are approximately 50 that are just outright entrapment jobs, like the poor kid in Lodi, California, or the Miami 7, and, you know, whatever, you pick your ones from the Northeast, the pizza plot, and there are a couple different pizza plots, and the Brooklyn Bridge, and all these. Anyway, so it's such great work that you've done there. The book is The Terror Factory, and now this new one is called How the FBI Created a Terrorist. It's the story of a guy named Sammy Osmakak. Is that right?
Osmakak is how it's pronounced.
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and back off and let you take it from there, Trevor.
Yeah, so I had a story that came out yesterday called The Sting, How the FBI Created a Terrorist, and it's about a case in Tampa, Florida, involving a young man named Sammy Osmakosh, who was convicted last year and in November was sentenced to 40 years in prison for his role in a plot to bomb an Irish bar in Tampa and then take hostages at a local Native American casino. What's interesting about this story is that it's kind of a new wrinkle in, you know, my research over the last few years on FBI sting operations, in that for the first time we have a transcript that shows what the FBI agents were saying as they were working on the sting operation.
Right.
You know, as you noted, the FBI has a proclivity for making it possible or providing the means and opportunity for someone to commit an act of terrorism who just doesn't have those means and opportunity. Often they are mentally ill or economically desperate. And the criticism of these cases is that the FBI is then setting them up in elaborate stings to commit crimes that they never on their own could have had the capacity for. What's interesting about Sammy's case is that the undercover agent who was leading this sting operation would go back to the Tampa field office and would go back and talk to his FBI colleagues, and he wasn't turning off his recording equipment. And so this was picking up the conversations he was having in private with the other FBI agents.
Busted like Nixon.
What's that?
Busted like Nixon.
Busted like Nixon, exactly. Exactly. And so the FBI agents, you know, there are two things that are concerning. One is that the FBI agents' comments, you know, are mean-spirited and certainly suggest that they didn't think that this guy was dangerous. You know, they call him a retarded fool who doesn't have a pot to piss in. They say that his terrorist ambitions are wishy-washy and it's a pipe dream scenario. You know, they make fun of his paranoia and the fact that he doesn't have any money. But the more troubling concern, the greater concern, I think, is that the central piece of evidence in the case was that Sammy Osmakosh had given an undercover agent posing as a terrorist $500 for weapons that were to be used in this plot. And at trial, the government made a big deal about this. What these transcripts show is that Sammy didn't have any money and that they needed to orchestrate to satisfy the Justice Department, Sammy having $500 so that he could give to an undercover agent. So they had an informant give Sammy a job, and then they funneled the money, which is the FBI's money, through the informant to Sammy Osmakosh, and then Sammy Osmakosh used that money as a down payment on the weapons. So essentially the plot was the FBI laundered money through an informant, and then Sammy used government money to purchase government weapons. And that was something that the jury never heard. You know, these transcripts were sealed under a protective order. The government basically argued national security, saying that their release would reveal investigative techniques and law enforcement strategy. We obtained the transcripts through a source and then based our story yesterday on those transcripts.
Wow. Yeah, and you mentioned in here about the judge sealing some other stuff, too, that was really important. I'm trying to remember what it was right offhand, but it sure looked like he was kind of in on it with the FBI, sealed the transcripts, of every bit of it, not just the part, I guess, really more importantly, what you just said about how they had orchestrated getting him the job and all that, but the part about them and, you know, making fun of the guy and calling him a retarded fool as well. This is the kind of thing where if this was an episode of Matlock or something, the judge would be mad as hell. And the judge would be using the term the government as though he's not part of it. He's an independent, separate judiciary. And his job is getting mad when the executive branch tries stunts like this. But instead, it seems more like he's a part of the executive branch, too. He might as well be an FBI agent, this judge.
You know, we do see a lot of that in these cases where the federal judges aren't willing to push back on the government's claims of national security privilege and, you know, seal records like this. You know, I've read these transcripts many times. There's nothing that I can see that is particularly sensitive to law enforcement strategy or national security, unless it is, you know, techniques on how to set someone up, which is what this shows.
Right.
It doesn't reveal the sources. Even the informant, who we do identify in the article, is not mentioned by name in this story. You know, it does mention the names of some FBI agents, but none of that is particularly you know, sensitive to national security. So that the government argued that this particular transcript was would damage the law enforcement strategy of the U.S. government if it came out is simply laughable, and it is concerning that a U.S. district judge was willing to seal these transcripts based on that claim alone.
Yeah, sure. I don't know. I guess now I'm, you know, claiming mind reading or whatever, but I guess the judge wouldn't hesitate if it was somebody else, you know, out of his favor, to conclude that the reason why is to obstruct justice, to prevent the jury from knowing the truth about what a scam this whole thing is. If they showed the jury the FBI agents joking and calling this guy, quote, a retarded fool, and at the same time that they're telling this jury that this guy's Al-Qaeda in America going to kill you if we didn't stop him and save you, that might piss the jury off. They might find him not guilty.
It's certainly possible. You know, it's worth noting that the jury, not having heard this evidence, took 6 hours to deliberate and find Sammy Osmakosh guilty. You know, I mean, I think a valid question is, you know, what effect these transcripts, if provided to the jury and used by the defense, you know, might have had in that deliberation.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Well, I guess that could be grounds for appeal, right? That they kept all this stuff from the defense and the jury, too. But hang on one sec, y'all. We'll be right back. It's Trevor Aronson. He's at firstlook.org/The Intercept, How the FBI Created a Terrorist. Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America. Columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at fusepowder.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Sorry that took so long. This is how it goes. I'm talking with Trevor Aronson. He does heroic journalism. This one's at The Intercept. How the FBI created a terrorist, about this poor guy who was basically crazy. I don't know exactly what kind of, I'm not a doctor. I'm just saying. He was a nobody, and they entrapped him into this elaborate so-called terrorist plot. I'm sorry, I want to get back to the story of who this guy is and how they entrapped him, because that's all very interesting. But break there, I was asking about we were talking about how the judge sealed all this stuff that you got in this exclusive leak to your that you wrote about here, all the transcripts and is it the audio too, I guess, of the meetings? Or is it just the audio, or is it the transcripts? Sorry.
It's just the transcripts. I wasn't able to scan the audio.
But yeah, anyway, they hid all this apparently from the defense and the jury. So is the defense appealing based on this? Because that's the Brady rule, that they have to turn over everything, right?
So the defense, I believe, was given access to this as part of the protective order, but they were prohibited from telling the jury anything about it as part of the seal, as part of the protective order. The process was kind of two-part. The first part was that a federal magistrate judge had sealed the transcripts in full and placed them under protective order and then prevented their release as part of the trial in any way. After Sammy Osmakosh was convicted and sentenced, they were unsealed in part. Only part of the transcripts were unsealed, and they were heavily redacted. The judge allowed the government to redact anything that it believed hurt law enforcement strategy or investigative privilege. And so for that reason, the transcripts that you can now get in the court file are limited, and what is available is heavily redacted. What we're providing as part of this story is the full transcripts, unredacted, showing how Sammy Osmakosh sting was put together from the transcripts.
Great,
from the conversations among private FBI agents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a hell of an exclusive that you got there. So now to get to the story here, if I read it right, you have the informant, Dabas, however you say it. His side of the story is that this guy came to me and said he wanted some guns. So I called the FBI on him. What was I supposed to do? So what's your answer to that?
So Sammy disputes this in whole. I mean, what the government claims is that Sammy had come to the store through a mutual contact, a man named Russell Dennison, whose story is unclear and somewhat suspicious. Russell Dennison had encouraged Sammy's extremism and then introduced him to this man named Abdul Dabus, who owned a Middle Eastern market. The FBI and DeBoost say that Osmakosh asked if he had any black banners or Al-Qaeda flags, and then that was the basis for the sting operation to begin. Sammy says that he never made that claim and that it was DeBoost who was kind of the one encouraging him to take a job with him. So there's the timeline of when the government targeted Sammy Osmakosh is a little suspicious. You either have to believe that he was introduced miraculously to an FBI informant, and that began the sting operation, or you have to question, for example, the government's filing of a FISA notification saying that he was subjected to some sort of FISA surveillance. There's a question of whether the government might have used parallel construction, which means that they identify a target through bulk surveillance and then use an informant to essentially manufacture a new predicate, a new reason to start the investigation, which in this case could be the Black Banners comment. Mm-hmm. But DeBoos, in my interview with him, he's now in Gaza, says that Sammy came to him, asked for black banners, also asked if he could provide him any weapons, and that he was just doing his civic duty in reporting Sammy to the FBI. He was paid $20,000, it's worth noting, for his work on the case. And it should also note that he says that he wasn't motivated by the money, that he was doing it out of his kind of civic obligation.
Mm-hmm. But now, you weren't able to pin down whether the red-bearded guy, his friend that did the introduction, Dennison, whether he was actually an FBI informant or not?
Dennison's story is really interesting. He's an American-born convert to Islam who did time for a minor drug offense in Pennsylvania, where, according to some videos he posted on YouTube, he suggested that that's when his faith was really kind of hardened and grew stronger, was when he was in prison. Dennison would dress in sandals and a thobe and in a very kind of conservative style, and he encouraged Sammy to do the same, and they in turn would make videos about, you know, ranting about non-believers and American culture and talking about Islam in these videos. And it was Dennison, according to Sammy's family, that really encouraged him toward kind of his extremism. And it was also Dennison who miraculously introduces Sammy to the FBI informant whose shop is 45 minutes away from Sammy's. So that on its own is fairly suspicious. Also, what's interesting is after Sammy's arrest, the FBI interviewed Dennison at Tampa Airport, where he said he was going to Detroit and later was going to Jordan to teach English. And in the interview with the FBI agent, Dennison tells him that he knows a man named Abu Khalid Abdul Latif, who was another mentally ill man who was targeted in an FBI sting operation, just like Sammy's, but in Seattle, Washington. And so it's pretty suspicious that this man happened to know two people who were targeted in FBI sting operations. Sammy's family thinks that Dennison is somehow a government agent, maybe not with the FBI, maybe another government agency, and that his job is to kind of draw out and bring to FBI informants people who are identified through bulk surveillance or other means by the government.
Yeah. All right, now, I mean, I guess it makes sense, right? If you're the FBI and you got to entrap somebody, who do you entrap? It's that somebody who's, you know, I guess, in effect, at least, of low IQ if they're kind of stuck in mental illness and not able to really differentiate, you know, up from down in numerous ways. That sort of counts for stupidity in a sense, right, for ease of manipulation. And here, again, as you say, and you quote them directly calling him a retarded fool, the FBI agents calling their prey, in this case, a retarded fool. Well, what was wrong with him? He was schizoaffective. What's that?
Yeah, so he was diagnosed. He was, after his arrest, he was seen by six psychologists and psychiatrists, two of whom were appointed by the court, two of whom hired by the defense, and the final two hired by the prosecution. The four that were hired by the defense or appointed by the court diagnosed Sammy Osmakosh with schizoaffective disorder. It's a psychotic disorder that means that you have trouble distinguishing between reality and fantasy, you know, from life, from dream. And there's transcripts in the undercover recordings when they were operating the sting on Sammy Osmakosh where he even talks about this. I mean, he talks to the informant about how he has a dream and he thought it was real. And, you know, that certainly supports this idea that, you know, he was having trouble distinguishing between reality and fantasy. And that, according to psychologists and psychiatrists hired by the defense, made him easily manipulated by the government. You know, it's worth noting, as in all cases like this, you know, each side hires an expert, and usually the opinion of the experts are in conflict with each other. The prosecution's experts were psychologists and psychiatrists who found that Sammy Osmakosh was not psychotic, but instead suffered from depression and acclimation disorder, which basically just means he had trouble acclimating to U.S. culture. But I also think it's worth noting that the independent psychologists and psychiatrists appointed by the court agreed with the defense experts in that Sammy Osmakosh had schizoaffective disorder. And so obviously someone who has trouble distinguishing between reality and fantasy is going to be someone who is much more easily convinced to do something by a strong-willed FBI informant. And the government, the defense's claim to the trial was that he was manipulated in this way.
Well, and you talk about here how his grand plan is to blow up five bridges all around Tampa, Florida. And then, you know, he's talking about that Batman movie, right, where they isolate Manhattan or whatever. And then they will all cower before me, right? Yes. In other words, it's make-believe. This is make-believe. This is not a thing that's even happening at all. The most that's happening about it at all is everything that the FBI informant is doing with the FBI's money and guns to make it seem as though something is happening. That's basically it.
Right. You know, I mean, it's interesting that when he's asked, like, what he would like to do, his idea is not necessarily a manageable one where he'd get a bomb or get even a gun. It's that he would want to blow up all of these bridges simultaneously, which is something that perhaps even a military operation would have difficulty doing. So, I mean, it does show kind of that he wasn't, you know, he wasn't grounded in any reality that you and I are, and that he was just kind of like, you know, as he was being asked these things, he was coming up with these wild ideas that should have suggested to the FBI that, you know, this guy isn't all there. You know, he's fairly crazy.
Yeah, well, and but now, so just how guilty did they trick him into being before they slapped the cuffs on him? What did they get him to do, really?
They provided to him an AK-47, which was non-functional, but Sammy didn't know that. They provided him with a car bomb, or what he thought was a car bomb, and they even gave him taxicab money so he could get to where they needed him to go. And then they also helped him make a so-called martyrdom video where he talked about why he believed what he believed and why he was going to go forward with this attack, which, of course, when they made this video, which the government recorded with its own camera, Sammy was wearing a suicide vest and an AK-47, all provided by the government. In the final scene, in the final stage, they get Sammy Osmakosh to take the car bomb from the undercover agent's car and put it in his own car. And then as he backs out of the hotel where they were at to go deliver the bomb, he stopped, arrested, and convicted. So they brought him up to the final stage, and that's what they made clear to the jury, that, you know, look, he was going to do it. This shows that. But in reality, he was only going to do it because everything was provided by the government. He'd been manipulated over several months, and frankly, he was not, you know, all there mentally. And yet the FBI was able to use all of this to portray to the public and portray to the jury that this was a dangerous man who would have struck, who would have committed significant violence were it not for the government intervening in this way. Scott?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sitting here talking with my mic off. I'm such an idiot. You know, the thing about it is that responsibility is a quality, not a quantity. So the FBI can be 100% guilty of entrapment and really playing a prank on the rest of us is exploiting this poor guy to do it. And well, at the same time, he is over 18. He is an individual with agency and was tricked into, you know, was successfully tricked. Nobody could trick Trevor Aronson into going through with something like this, right? So, you know, I don't know. Are you sure that if you're on the jury, he deserves to be acquitted? I mean, maybe this whole thing can be a giant scam by the FBI, but also he's guilty too. What do you think?
No, I agree. And that's what makes this topic so difficult and so gray in many ways, because the people that are caught in these sting operations like Sammy Osmakosh, you know, I'm not making the argument that these are angels, that these are perfect people and they were, you know, productive, law-abiding citizens. I mean, certainly the people that are caught in sting operations are deeply troubled. Some may have committed minor offenses in the past. Sammy Osmakosh certainly was an example of someone who was deeply troubled and had problems and may have committed some sort of crime. So I'm not saying Sammy Osmakosh would have been someone you would have invited over for dinner and would have become, you know, the nicest guy you know, because he wasn't. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that he is a terrorist who should be prosecuted under laws and sentencing guidelines that were written with the, you know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds of the world in mind. Yeah. And that's really what's happening. I mean, the problem is, and the difference is that, yes, these guys are kind of bad guys. You know, they're not the nicest people, but they're not terrorists. They don't have the capability to commit the types of crimes that the government is making it out for them to commit through these sting operations. And so while you can't argue that, yes, maybe Sammy Osmakosh is guilty of something, you know, maybe he is someone who should be in a mental health system and may have been someone who would have been picked up in a mental health system were the United States one better funded than it is. But he is not the hardened terrorist that he's portrayed to be. And he certainly is not the person who could have delivered a car bomb on his own and could have acquired an AK-47. You know, the FBI agents in the transcripts we obtained even joke about the fact that Sammy Osmakosh has no clue whatsoever how much a weapon costs on the black market. And so, you know, that's the type of person you're talking about for capability. He had no money, and even if he had money, he'd have no idea how much money he'd need to buy the weapon he'd want. And so I think that's the difference. I mean, the difference is that, yes, these guys are not the nicest people, but they're not the terrorists that they're portrayed to be by the FBI.
Right. And, you know, we see this over and over and over again, is that they're usually very simple people, like the kid, like Lodi, California, or the Brooklyn Bridge and the subway plot where they found the retarded kid down at the bookstore. And it's just, the only question is, who can we trick into saying they love Osama? Basically, that's the only quality that they're searching for is who can be manipulated. But now, is it okay if I keep you one more second here, or you got
to
go?
No, of course. I'm happy to
stay. Okay, cool. I wonder, and I'm sorry, I forget now whether this is in the book or not. It's been a few years, but have they had to adapt just how entrapped somebody can be before a case gets dismissed in order to accommodate this bogus domestic terror war since September 11th?
You know, I mean, arguing entrapment is a difficult defense no matter what you're charged with. You know, you could be charged with conspiring to rob a bank. The problem with entrapment is that you have to say, yes, I did it, but I wouldn't have done it were it not for the government agent overwhelming my will. And I think that's a workable defense for other types of crime. For a Muslim charged with terrorism, you know, in a climate where we are still very afraid of another attack, I think it's an almost impossible defense. I think it's almost impossible for a jury to have empathy for someone in that situation, particularly when they're not aware that this is you know, a kind of stock and trade for the government in, you know, setting people up in sting operations. And so for that reason, the government has received little, if any, pushback from the judiciary and from juries on this type of case. You know, Sammy was the 12th person to argue entrapment following one of these sting operations, and he wasn't successful. In fact, no one has been successful arguing entrapment after a terrorism sting operation. And I think that's only further emboldened the FBI to use these types of tactics because, you know, the FBI really has two checks on its power, Congress and the courts. And Congress really isn't providing much oversight. And the courts are letting these cases through. And even seeing, like in this one, you know, the sealing of transcripts under national security privileges that are kind of highly questionable in their justification. And, you know, for that reason, the FBI for the last decade has really had carte blanche in working these types of cases. And, you know, if you judge its success by the number of arrests and the number of convictions, you know, this is a great program. But really, it's about judging it on whether these people were actually terrorists and whether this is keeping us safer as a result.
Yep. All right. Hey, thanks for coming back on the show. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. As always, I enjoyed it.
Great. And great work. That's Trevor Aronson. Everybody's at firstlook.org/The Intercept, How the FBI Created a Terrorist. The book is The Terror Factory, and there's also an article like that at motherjones.com where he goes, you know, the full litany for you there. We'll be right back in just a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Cool.
I'm reading this thing at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists about what it would be like if the Russians nuked New York City with an 800 kiloton H-bomb. Less than a megaton? Really? How nice of you guys. Anyway, yeah, that would be pretty ugly, man. I guess it's kind of bound to happen someday, huh? Hope not. Be like that movie, which call where the president does it. Ah, come on, don't forget the name of the movie. Chat room, help me. My brain forgot the name of the movie. You know, the one where the president nukes New York. It came out right around the same time as Dr. Strangelove. Anyway. So, yeah, that's a pretty interesting article. I'm going to have to read this whole thing. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. What would happen if an 800-kiloton nuclear warhead detonated above Midtown Manhattan? Everybody on the island would die, and a whole bunch of everybody else in the boroughs, too. That's what. Kill all of New York in one shot with an H-bomb. Richard Mayberry says that it's going to happen to D.C. someday. And not that he's claiming to know about any plans. And I think he actually believes that nukes get a little bit looser than they really do. But he says you just can't go around making this many enemies and think that someday, or, you know, think that you'll be immune forever from that kind of response. I don't know. I kind of think sometimes this show should be nothing but an anti-nuke show. And what other priority in the world, you know, could possibly rank anywhere on the same scale as we gotta abolish the nukes? And I'm totally susceptible to the whole, I don't know, they don't use them on each other. It's prevented the great powers from going to war for quite a few decades now. It's a great insurance policy. How to keep out of a really, really, really bad war. Make sure your own government's capital city is at stake. Where all the people who will be getting you into the war could also die in the damn thing. And that'll stop them from waging it. Mutually assured destruction. The balance of terror. That's what they called it. The nuclear weapons theorists. Albert Wolfstetter, Paul Wolfowitz's teacher. The balance of terror. It works. It has worked so far, but the day it stops working, we'll all die in gigantic thermonuclear balls of fire, as this article continues to stress repeatedly here, hotter than the sun by quite a bit. Hotter than the sun. Who wants to lose their city like that, you know? I don't know. I hope if the war does start, the first one lands right on my head. I don't know. Be around for any of the aftermath of that, but man, be pretty hot. And right now, America and Russia both have approximately between, say, 5,000 and 7,000 H-bombs each. And then once you get to lower than that, it may be the Israelis who are in third place. With approximately 600, according to Daniel Ellsberg, who was told that by Mordecai Vanunu himself, the Israeli nuclear weapons whistleblower. And I know that the usual estimates are lower than that, but Ellsberg says that Ellsberg told me that Vanunu told him that they have 600 and including H-bombs. And then you have the Brits and the French. They have less than 100 each, I think. 50, 25 or 50 each. I just saw these numbers not too long ago. And the same with the Chinese, by the way. They have certainly less than 100 operational ones. Well, I don't know, certainly. Reportedly, I believe, they have less than 100. That ought to be enough to deter America from attacking Beijing. I'd like to hope. But you know what? We didn't have a permanent state of war and a world empire and all this madness. This is one of the things that we could be making right about the world right now, instead of just trying to oppose all the wrong stuff all the time. Hey, you know what we could do? We could go ahead and burn that plutonium in reactors to provide electricity to people who need electricity. How about that? How about let's break down the nuclear weapons? Let's have a moratorium on anything but conventional explosives. And you know what? Hey, look at the daisy cutters and the Moab bombs. These multi-thousand pound bombs. These governments can kill plenty of people without splitting or fusing atoms. Right? Just take all their nukes away. And you know, I don't know. I guess I'm under the impression that people are under the impression that only patchouli stinking hippies think that, but does that really make sense? In fact, Henry Kissinger and George Shultz and formerly Chuck Hagel before he had to renounce the position. These guys, a lot of these hoity-toity CFR types have signed on to this thing, the Global Zero, to get rid of the nukes. And now, hell, that maybe they want, you know, some new global army to have a monopoly on them if we're talking about Kissinger and those guys. But I don't know. I don't think so. And it doesn't have to be a world government monopoly on nukes in order to just have mutual disarmament and mutual inspection and guarantees. And then, yeah, people could cheat and make nukes again. But, well, you know, it's just like there's, you know, plenty of slavery still in the world, but at least it's illegal in most places and being fought kind of thing. Same thing with the nukes. Maybe we won't ever be able to absolutely abolish them. But think about it like this. If it would have to be a right-wing Republican president, right? Like only Nixon can go to China kind of thing. It'd have to be a right-wing Republican president says, you know what? We're getting rid of all the nukes. And I don't give a damn, Congress. You can scream your heads off. Energy Department job holders, scream if you want. We're getting rid of them all. And world, be on notice. We can still bomb you with conventional explosives. So try not to start any fights with us. And then that'd be fine. That would be fine. Who's going to start a fight with us if we didn't have H-bombs anymore? The Japanese? The French? We could still level their capital cities. We still got all the F-15s in the world. I know our F-35s can't make it over there, but I mean, they can if you ship them in a box on a boat. But with the F-15s and the B-1s and the B-2s and the B-52s and they all know that we can bomb the hell out of them. We could deter. In fact, now that I'm ranting and raving about it, Robert Gates, when he was the Secretary of Defense, there was a study put out by the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And I believe it was by some Air Force colonels and generals even. And what they said was they would be happy with 14 nukes. 14, period, nukes. Because that's enough to convince any state that, man, don't mess with us because we got 14 of them. And that'll be plenty, you know? So there you go. You shouldn't need any more argument from authority than that. If even the Republican Secretary of Defense, the guy who, he's the reason that they missed the fall of the Soviet Union because he was such a hawk on pretending the Soviet Union had all this power that they didn't have, that he didn't see that they were falling apart completely right in front of his eyes over there at the CIA, as Ray McGovern has told the story over and over, and others too. But anyway, if Robert Gates can settle for 14 nukes, then it seems like that could be the good start of policy. And if America really did adopt a policy like that in good faith and negotiated with the Russians and the Chinese and the rest of our allies, all the rest of the... We're friends with India and Pakistan, right? I mean, we could negotiate nukes right out of the hands of everybody if the Americans would lead the way. But that's some comic book America that never really existed where, you know, we mean what we say about peace and justice and stuff. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me. The social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, fail-safe, of course. I asked the chat room for help, and then I didn't look at it again for 10 minutes. Failsafe. That's the movie where the president, well, he nukes New York. Maybe that's a spoiler alert kind of thing, but then again, the movie is from the 1960s, so I think it's okay. And anyway, did you ever notice in that movie, JDA 2000? Oh, it was number six. Was it number six? No, it was JDA 2000. Hey, JDA 2000, did you ever notice when you watched that movie that a fair trade for Moscow would have been D.C., not New York? Why did nuke New York? Damn politicians, man. Such scum. All right. Anyway, so listen, man, one more thing about the nukes, which I meant to say in the last segment, but I didn't think of it again. I put it off for a second to say something else, and then I didn't get back to it until the commercial. Daniel Ellsberg. He wrote a series. He's writing a book about it right now. But he wrote a series for Truth Dig back, say, in 2000 and, I don't know, 10 or 11 or something. And it's a 3 or 4 part series. I think it begins with Nuclear Holocaust, something like that. Anyway, it's really good, man. And the thing about it that you should know about Daniel Ellsberg is he's not just the guy that leaked the Pentagon Papers. He's the guy that helped write the Pentagon Papers. And he's the guy who helped design nuclear warfare policy in the Pentagon. I forget exactly now. It's been a while. But, you know, his father actually designed the assembly line for making the A-bomb. And then resigned and refused the contract to design the factory to build the H-bomb. Because, man, no. H-bombs? No, dude, I ain't doing that. Anyway, true story. So that's who Daniel Ellsberg is, man. He knows what he's talking about this stuff, dude. And, you know, one of the things that you'll see if you look at that, it's funny, man. It's like, it looks like third grade homework, right? It's the most simple little line graph of here's how many hundreds of millions of people will be killed in the first days of a nuclear war with Russia. How many hundreds of millions of people will die? You know, World War II, the singular name for the series of events that amount to the worst thing that ever happened, ever. That's 60 million dead. That's 60 million dead. That'd be a nuclear war, a real nuclear war, would have all of World War II beat in a day. For, you know, the record of what would be a pile of skulls if they hadn't been turned completely to dust. Yeah. Good time. So, why to get rid of the nukes? And Dan Ellsberg is one. And here's one more thing to point out about that. And you can Google this up and find lots of examples. There have been a lot of almosts. There have been, you know, I looked recently for the list of 20 and I couldn't find it. At one point, I had found a list of 20 almosts where we could have had a full-scale nuclear war with the Russians based on accident or misunderstanding or a screw-up or a small skirmish that got out of control or... you know, had a guy write to me earlier about, you know, Mikey Weinstein's always complaining about the premillennialists. Is it the postmillennialists? It's the postmillennialists, dispensationalists in the, right. Wait, I might be screwing up my pre and my post. What the hell do I know? But anyway, no, it's the premillennialists, right? Anyway, in the Air Force, they want a nuclear war for Jesus. They're completely out of control, and they're in the Air Force High Command. And Mikey Weinstein's been complaining about that for a long time and has that organization for freedom of religion in the military, in the U.S. military. Forgot the exact name of it. But anyway, somebody was just writing me recently and saying, hey, that is a real thing, man, that you have – it's been decided kind of that – this is the service that we want to concentrate on, right? So they control the planes that deliver the nukes. Oh, well. Sleep tight. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Okay. And now, here's business. Important business, man, I got to talk to you about. Today's the last day of the Kickstarter, and you guys have already donated 200% of what I asked for in the first place. That's for almost $700. And you guys have donated more than that, $1,553 so far. So thank you very much. And I think, I hope what that means is that maybe I can come up with a few other things for this computer genius to help me with too. I think I've already thought of some. Like, what if we could get him for a couple of few hundred bucks more to do the same thing, take all the interviews and put them all on SoundCloud? That might help get some new listens too, don't you think? Maybe I could get him to do that too. So anyway, thank you. You guys are so generous. God dang, man. And in fact, just got, you know, one or two more backers. I mean, the thing went quiet because we were way over our goal. Thing went quiet for most of a week there. And then somebody else just added a few more dollars there just the other day. And now, so tomorrow will be the big day at 11 in the morning. Then all of you who pledged, I guess, will get taxed. And then I promise you all of this money is going into the show, and the prizes and the rewards that you get for the donation that are all baked into the price there at Kickstarter.com. And so 1 million thank yous to you guys for all the support. And I'm going to be doing another one of these soon for a couple of servers. But first, we're going to get this out of the way. And, you know, somebody emailed me the other day and said, man, here's, I think, 7 or 8 Gordon Prather interviews that don't work. What? Oh, no. Well, that's part of this. That's step one of this project, is to get the master list of all the MP3 archives that don't work and make sure that they all work, that all the addresses are correct and all the MP3s are there from the archives. I don't know how they get missing from the server like that sometimes. But anyway, make sure we're at all 3,600 and something interviews on there before we get them transferred over to YouTube. So that's getting fixed. That's part of this. And then, I don't know. Thanks again. Cool. Oh, what time is it? You know, I thought I was out of time, but I still got 30 seconds. So I'll tell you this. When we get back, I'm going to talk about the Iranian nuclear talks and the Israelis and what they're trying to do with them. Ooh, and then when we get back from that, I'm going to tell you about Russia and Ukraine. So, I hope that you will like it. It's the Scott Horton Show here on the Liberty Radio Network. Play music, play. What are you doing to me? Is it playing? It's playing. All right, back in a few. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And I don't really expect things to change too much if Netanyahu gets unelected, but I would like to see him unelected. I guess I agree with MJ Rosenberg. He's on Twitter saying, I just want to see this bastard humiliated, that's all. I can agree with that. I don't know, this Herzog guy. I'm afraid to say that he couldn't possibly be as bad as Netanyahu, because, boy, what if that turns out to be wrong? And who even knows if he's really the most likely to win, if not Netanyahu? I don't know. We'll see what happens with this thing. Anyway. So listen, Iran news here. They're still working on the deal. And I like to think that, they pretty much have the deal and that they're just kind of riding this out for political reasons. But I don't really know. I guess the best of my understanding, the Americans have still not agreed, even kind of wink nudge agreed, to lift the sanctions kind of all at once up front. and the Iranians have not agreed to back off of that demand. That is still an outstanding issue of how long it's going to take for the sanctions to be lifted. I don't know how big of an issue it is. I don't know if it's even really still outstanding, but supposedly it is. And then there's also, I think there's questions I just read the other day about snap inspections at facilities that are not nuclear facilities. Or, you know, ones that perhaps are claimed to be like Parchin, where there's nothing nuclear there. But it's part of a scam that the Western powers are pretending to believe in about a bogus testing chamber that was never located there because it's all a lie. A debunked one. But anyway, that seems to be something that there's still seems qualification to be something that they're still negotiating over. So I don't know, man, if it's a done deal or not. I guess it really ain't. And I guess it all comes down to politics. I saw the Republicans gloating about a story that the Iranians are bringing up, the Tom Cotton Rand Paul letter telling them don't bother negotiating with Obama because, you know, when our guy wins next, we're not going to abide by it. And they're saying, oh, good, it's having the intended effect, undermining the talks. And, of course, Rand Paul piss all over your shoes and then tell you it's raining. Oh, me? Well, I signed the letter in order to strengthen Obama's position. Oh, yeah? Finish that sentence. How so? Go ahead. We're listening. How's this strengthen Obama's hand? Nothing. Of course not. He did it because he was sucking up to the war party, and then I guess he thought, uh-oh. Libertarians got too mad on that one. I don't know what his problem is. Why he flip-flops around. I thought about tweeting to Jennifer Rubin. Hey, were you sufficiently impressed by this? Do you think Sheldon Adelson will be sufficiently impressed by Rand Paul signing this letter? Or he'll never be good enough? Just for a little clarity's sake. Thanks. But, yeah. Anyway, here the Senate... Oh, so here's the sanctions in the Senate. We thought maybe that the backlash from Netanyahu's speech and then from this letter, too, 47 traitors and all that stuff, that maybe the Senate Republicans, and it's Menendez from New Jersey, is the co-sponsor of the new sanctions, that they're waiting on passing, but they're counting their votes and they're checking to see whether they have a veto-proof majority here. And according to Jason Ditz here at news.antiwar.com from yesterday, 2 days ago, Senate Dems prepare to defy Obama, oppose Iran deal. Growing group may put bills on cusp of override. Outrage over last week's letter from Senate Republicans to Iran threatening to dishonor any nuclear deal Obama reached is beginning to subside. And with it, a new round of comments are coming from Democrats indicating their support for, if not the letter, the sentiments behind it. Several Democrats are now publicly expressing their support for various resolutions that aim to sabotage the talks, either by imposing new sanctions on Iran in violation of the interim deal, or by seeking a veto over the deal that would make it impossible for the U.S. to be part of the process. The thing is, I don't know, man. All this, the point of this story is that the Democrats in the Congress are scum. Because in reality, if they get a deal, then these guys are going to have to shut up. Because the deal isn't just an American executive deal with Iran. It's the UN Security Council. It's all the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. That's the P5 plus one. The allies of World War II. U.S., Britain, France, Russia and China. And so we all know it's the Americans on behalf of the Israelis that have the real problem here. But anyway, if the deal is done, it is done between the greatest powers on earth. And the Democrats in the Congress not at least not under a Democratic president are they going to go and try to ruin that and undermine that, I don't think. But then again, Barack Obama is a big bitch, and people have their way with him all the time. So, I'm sorry, ladies. I don't mean any offense in a sexist way. I just mean the guy can really be a pushover sometimes on things where he really does not have to be. And who knows if they'll even get the deal. I mean, it could be that they don't even want the deal. I don't know. I think they want it, but they're willing to not get it, too. But I don't know if you believe in democracy at all. Maybe call your senator, if you got a Democratic senator, and tell him that, hey, man, boy, would we think that you're a traitor if you did this or something. We'll donate to your opponent. But, you know, Netanyahu promised he would do everything he could to oppose the deal. And that's what the letter from Tom Cotton and them is. And that's what these Senate Democrats are doing. That's what the speech was about when he came and gave the speech to try to turn the Congress against the president on this. And now people make the comparison. What if the Democrats had brought Jacques Chirac to come and oppose the Iraq War? Well, hey, at least that would have been trying to oppose the start of an aggressive war against a country that hadn't attacked us. This is a government that has an enemy government that is determined to keep America in a position where they're our enemy too. Even when our president is trying to negotiate a de facto peace deal here, at least the first major step on ending the Cold War against Iran. So it's hardly a comparison in any way. And, you know, there was an Israeli paper. I guess if an American had done this, it would be a horrible or anti-Semitic conspiracy theory or something. But it was an Israeli paper did this video where they edited the speech of just having Netanyahu say, stand, sit down, stand, sit down. And the U.S. Congress, the greatest legislative body in the world, as Netanyahu called it. Well, they called him His Excellency. Seriously, John Boehner introduced Netanyahu as His Excellency. I seen it. I heard it myself. And he's saying, stand up, sit down. And then they stand up and sit down. Doing everything they can to undermine the deal. But I think that they're still, I'm giving it like 60-40, man. That they're going to get the deal, and that then all the politics will be in the president's hands, and the Republicans will lose, and the Democrats won't join them, and the president will veto, and the deal will stick, and then Jeb will stick with it too. Because what's he going to do? The same as his brother did to North Korea? And kick him out of the deal and drive him toward nuclear weapons? In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. So yeah, somebody sent me this article about Egypt that I haven't gotten to read yet. Looks interesting, though. Well, I'll see what I can do. All right. So, yeah, Putin's not dead. But he says he was considering killing us all. Putin mulled putting nuclear forces on alert over Crimea. And what do you think? America was going to invade? Come on. Vladimir Putin said he was ready to put the country's nuclear forces on alert as he sought to annex Crimea last year after the fall of a Moscow-backed government in Kiev. As Raymond Govern pointed out on the show yesterday, not a shot was fired. Nobody died in the invasion of Crimea. So what's the opposite of that? Putting your nukes on alert over it. In a nearly 3-hour documentary aired on state TV in Russia, Putin showed the lengths he was willing to go in order to protect Russian-speaking citizens of the province he considered a historic slice of Russia. I'll get to the part. Asked whether Russia was ready to put its nuclear forces on alert, Putin said, "We were ready to do this." He said he fielded many calls from foreign leaders and told them that this is a, that's it. That's all you're going to say about the nuke thing? That's all he said about the nuke thing? Well, whatever. Eh, you know what? That's a lot bigger headline than news story. He mulled, says the headline. I don't know if he mulled it. But, you know, I don't know, man. Look at the use your imagination thing. What if you're the leader of Russia and you had NATO expanding to include all of Europe? Do Americans even know what NATO is? NATO is a military alliance. NATO says right now that if Lithuania ever gets into a tangle with Russia, that we will go to full-scale nuclear war to keep Russia out of Lithuania. That's what NATO is. That we will kill all of humanity and certainly extinguish our own civilization for Lithuania. And if the American War Party had it their way, Ukraine. So, if you were the leader of Russia, and you had the Americans expanding the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was expanded, which was created after World War II to keep the Soviets out of Western Europe, and it had expanded to include all of Eastern Europe right up to your border, including Poland, including the Baltic states, not Belarus, and not yet Ukraine. But if it was announced that Ukraine was on track to become a NATO member, and then the Americans backed a Nazi coup d'etat in Kiev that overthrew the Russian-leaning government there. Yeah. You might annex Crimea. You know, I don't know. It's amazing the way the Americans continue to pretend that this is somehow all about Russian aggression. Ray McGovern was on the show yesterday and said that he was talking to a pastor somewhere, I guess. He was giving a speech. He was talking to a minister at a church who was talking about the hundreds and thousands of people who died in the Russian invasion of Crimea. And Ray asked him, you know, how many people do you think died? And he didn't know. I don't know. Thousand? Hundreds or thousands? And Ray said, would you believe nobody died? He didn't say what the guy's answer was, but he must have had to defer to the former Soviet expert from the CIA telling him, man, that wasn't a war. And, you know, I don't know. I'm an anarchist, an individualist anarchist, and I don't really believe in states. And so if anyone on the Crimean Peninsula didn't want to be incorporated into Russia, then I guess in a sense their rights were violated, but nobody else seems to be a libertarian. The standard seems to be everywhere else, majority rules. Well, in this case, it was super-duper majority rules there. And not only that, but it couldn't have possibly been any other way. And Putin just made fun of this in his speech. He said, you know, we thought that maybe we would like to go down to Sevastopol to visit our NATO friends there at their new Navy base. At our old Navy base. And what we decided was, you know what? We like the NATO guys so much that we would like to invite them to come and visit us instead. Rather than us going to visit them at our old base. So, he just made sure of it. That was all. And then, so, you know, I don't know, man. History ain't static and we're at a ceasefire now. But the Americans and the Brits just keep making matters worse. The Brits have sent soldiers. There have been off and on and off again announcements that the Americans are sending Army and or National Guard to train their National Guard, a.k.a. their Nazis, the Azov Battalion and the Right Sector Nazi Brigades of Banderists. And here the Americans have sent or are sending 3,000 armored vehicles. No, I got that wrong. They're sending 100 armored vehicles and 3,000 troops to go train. There's a comma in that, and I need to read more carefully while I'm talking. I was going to say, 3,000 armored personnel carriers? Boy, that's a good commission for some Lockheed salesman there, huh? Anyway, and then here from Defense News, U.S. Army official, Atlantic Resolve may expand. Think about that, Atlantic Resolve. Don't you mean Black Sea Resolve? Maybe we can go as far as the Caspian, guys. Atlantic Resolve is the name of this operation in Eastern Europe, where they're just they're doing exercises in the Czech Republic, Romania, and Bulgaria. They're sending more troops, and they're doing exercises in Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and they're going to expand all through the summer. And in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, in I believe it was in Latvia. I forget. It was one of the Baltic states. I think it was in Latvia. They did a military parade, a NATO military parade, where you had American tanks 300 yards from the Russian border. Right? We're not talking about, you know, spitballs back and forth at Checkpoint Charlie halfway across Germany. We're talking about on the Russian border, you got American tanks picking a fight that they can't win. Not really picking a fight, it's just a parade, but they're being a real jerk about it. What are they doing? And then, so what do they think is going to happen if they send all these weapons and armored personnel carriers to back up, to build up the Ukrainian military, to undermine Minsk too, and to go back to war against, I know I can't pronounce them right. I should get the wife to help me pronounce them right. Donetsk and Luhansk or whatever, the eastern provinces there. Then what are the Russians going to do? I guess then maybe they'll march to Mariupol, and then everyone will say, Russian aggression, Russian aggression, Russian aggression. Stop reacting to our action. Every time you do, we're going to pretend you started it. And then, I don't know, at that point, maybe we'll send them a bunch of tanks, maybe break off some USAF airstrikes, and then when they march all the way to Odessa, or maybe to Kiev, then we'll say, look, Putin, for no reason other than, you know, greed and imperialism, has decided to conquer Ukraine. And history began yesterday. Let's have a nuclear war, even though Ukraine is not a member of NATO. You know, the best thing we have going for us in this situation right now is that the Ukrainian military sucks. Thank God. And major portions of it have gone over to the other side. Hey, I'm not from the East, but I'm not going to war against the East. I quit, they said. And there's massive defiance of the new conscription laws. And so, at this point, you know, Obama's just acting like Woodrow Wilson, basically. Taking a stalemate and a ceasefire and trying to see if he can make a worse crisis out of it. A crisis that America created in the first place. It's amazing. And still backing Nazis over there. Real Hitler-loving Nazis. Hey, thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.